Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey there, welcome to The Dr. Nina Show. I'm Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin. I'm a psychoanalyst specializing in food, weight, and body image issues, and I'm here to help you break free of the diet trap and lose weight without dieting. That means no more counting calories or carbs, no more thinking about food all the time. It really is possible to lose weight and gain health all without ever going on another diet. So today's topic is the truth about food addiction. And if you'd like to call in and talk with me, the number is 818-602-4929. That's 818-602-4929. You can also tweet me at Win the Diet War. So the topic of food addiction was inspired by a question I got from Linda, who lives in Manchester, England. Isn't that where the Beatles are from? Wait, nope, that's Liverpool. Sorry, Linda from Manchester. Okay, so Linda wrote kind of a long email, and I'm going to summarize. So the gist of it was, she asked me why I don't seem to believe in the concept of food addiction. And she's right. She said, I'm on board with your philosophy, except when it comes to food addiction. Everything I've read seems to indicate that food addiction is scientifically proven. So why do you believe otherwise? Okay, so that is a great question, Linda. And I'm going to answer by telling you about one of my patients, who I'm going to call Abby. Abby thought she was a sugar addict. Totally addicted. She used to say that sugar was her quote-unquote personal crack. That is how she put it. It's my personal crack. So Abby came to me for help with what she called her sugar addiction. And, you know, she was obsessed with sugar and hated that she had no willpower and just could not stop eating sugar. It was so bad that when Abby baked cookies with her daughter, who was like 5 or 6 years old, she would send the kid out of the kitchen, make up some excuse to get her out of the kitchen and go get something for her, so she, Abby, could eat cookie dough alone. And she hated herself for doing this. She just could not stop. Now, at the time, Abby was going through a really painful divorce, and she also did not love her job. In fact, we could say she pretty much hated her job. So Abby was having a really tough time. And sugar both comforted her and distracted her from all these problems. So I guess you could say she did not have enough sweetness in her life, literally and figuratively. So sugar was her main source of, well, fun. If we don't have enough fun in our lives, we can get really dependent on using food for fun, using food for enjoyment, for celebration. And the opposite is true. The more fun we're having, the less we need food for that purpose. Now, Abby dealt with the pain of her divorce. She changed jobs. She took up some new hobbies. She started doing Pilates and going to pottery classes. So baking cookies became something fun to do with her daughter, not an exercise in willpower. And eventually, Abby could bake cookies without binging on cookie dough at all. She could even eat cookie dough in moderation. She could have a cookie or two and be satisfied without that craving for more and more and more. Now, a recovered alcoholic cannot have just one drink. A meth or heroin addict cannot stop at just one hit, or whatever the term is. How was it possible for Abby, the self-proclaimed sugar addict, to have just one bite of cookie dough or just one cookie? Because Abby really thought she was a food addict. And lots of people who feel powerless over food consider themselves food addicts. But, okay, here's the thing. Is food addiction real? So let me first give you a little bit of the science behind the theory of food addiction, which is this. When we eat sugary or fatty foods, there's a release of dopamine in our brains. Dopamine is the chemical that mediates pleasure and motivation. So you eat sugar, you get that dopamine rush, and you feel pretty good. And then you have to eat increasing amounts to get the same experience you previously felt with less. And the reason for that has to do with what's called down-regulating of dopamine receptors. It's a little bit of dense science, but the basic idea is, you know, your brain starts decreasing dopamine levels to keep things balanced when you eat foods with high dopamine levels. So anyway, the upshot is you need more dopamine to get the same effect that you did before. Also, there have been studies that show that people with fewer dopamine receptors also have less activity in the prefrontal cortex of the brain. That's the area responsible for executive function, which oversees the regulation and control of memory, reasoning, problem solving, and impulsivity, which obviously has implications for binge eating and overeating. So, okay, that's enough of the science lesson. So if we look at the theory of food addiction in this way, changes in our brains are evidence of substance addiction, which sounds reasonable, right? Well, actually, there is more to the story. Sugar does change our brains. It does. But guess what? Anything involving pleasure changes our brains, including sex, exercise, spending time with friends. In fact, get this, one study proved that listening to classical music had the same impact on the brain as cocaine. And by the way, psychotherapy also changes the brain and can be even more effective than medication. That is also a scientific fact. And by the way, if you'd like the references for all these studies I'm talking about, just shoot me an email through my website, Win the Diet War, and I'd be happy to send you all the information on these studies. So here's another interesting study. A few years ago, some researchers set out to prove that food addiction was a real thing. And what they did was they asked research participants to eat more of their forbidden foods. And the hypothesis was, hey, these people are going to start eating forbidden foods and they will not be able to stop. And that's going to prove once and for all that food is an addictive substance. But you know what happened? Well, things did not go as planned. Because when the research participants got permission to eat these so-called addictive forbidden foods, they ate less instead of more. It was the opposite of what the food addiction theorists predicted. And this highlights how important the psychological aspect of food issues are, because our brains do not operate alone, and our minds do not function independently of our brains. If we just focus on our brain as the reason for our behavior, then we see ourselves as no more than lab rats, unable to think or reason, just driven by brain-based drives. And that is absolutely not the case. That ignores the other influences on us, social, cultural, our families, our friends, our environment, and our unconscious minds. So keep in mind, if you are turning to food, it is for a reason, for comfort, to alleviate anxiety, to distract from painful or upsetting thoughts, even to sleep, to symbolically fill a void, to calm down. There are many, many, many reasons. Eating is a way of managing what's going on inside. It is the mind's way of protecting itself. So if you'd like to call me and talk with me about this subject or anything else that's on your mind, the number's 818-602-4929. Doesn't have to be about food addiction. It could be whatever is bothering you and that has to do with food weight or body image. Now, if you're listening to this and thinking, you know, That's just not true. My life is fine. I just wake up and right away I go for the food. I'm a true addict. Well, you may not be in touch with whatever is upsetting or bothering you. In my first show, I shared the story of Jenna, who thought she was addicted to ice cream. If you missed that show, let me give you a quick recap. So Jenna was watching TV and all of a sudden Ben and Jerry's was calling her name. That's how she put it. She said nothing was wrong, everything was fine. She seriously thought she was addicted to Chunky Monkey. It turned out that the TV show she was watching had activated some intense anxiety about her relationship to her sisters. The show was about sisters fighting. And before that anxiety could even reach consciousness, she was not even aware of it. She turned to ice cream for comfort and relief. Again, that's where the mind comes in. So you could actually say that Jenna was addicted to using ice cream to alleviate anxiety. But that's not a substance addiction. That's what's called a process addiction, which is an addiction to the behavior. So she wasn't addicted to ice cream, the substance. She was using ice cream for distraction and comfort and relief. I guess you could think of it more as an eating addiction rather than a food addiction or a sugar addiction. So here's the good news if you're struggling with this. You can change. We can change. Our thoughts release neurotransmitters, which are brain chemicals that communicate information. When you change your thoughts, which have to do with your mind, you eventually change the neural pathways in your brain. So what does all this mean? It's called brain plasticity, which is a fancy term for saying you can learn new ways. We can learn how to do things differently. You can learn new ways of relating and responding to yourself. And in time, those new ways become your new reality. When you harness the power of your mind to understand what's going on inside, when you find new ways of responding to yourself, you create new habits that eventually feel as familiar and even as comfortable as the old ones. So if you're automatically turning to food when you're upset, you can learn new ways to comfort yourself. It takes time, but it is possible if you put your mind to it. I just thought of a patient who told me he didn't believe he was ever going to be able to stop binging. He'd been binging for 30 years, every day. Didn't think it was ever going to change. And he used to say that every day with food was like battling a tiger. Until the day he came in and said he wasn't battling a tiger anymore. Now, he said, it was just a pussycat, and he was going to tame it. Okay. So, again, my call-in number is 818-602-4929. If you'd like to talk with me, I'd love to talk with you. Okay, so lots of times people tell me that their eating issues don't make sense to them. They tell me they know what they have to do to lose weight, they need to eat right and exercise, and they can't do it. Or if they do, they just can't keep doing it. And they tell me, this is not logical. I know what I need to do. I can't do it. It doesn't make sense. And my answer is, yes, that's right. It is not logical. But it is psychological. And here's something to think about. Diets are ultimately about deprivation of some kind. And the anticipation of deprivation makes you want something more. So if you're thinking that you cannot have pizza, pasta, chips, or ice cream until you lose that 5, 10, 20, 50, 100 pounds or more, then you will have food on the brain and you will want what you cannot have. And this is what happened to Melissa, who was a stay-at-home mom with three boys. My hat is off to her, three boys. I can't even imagine. It's just at a party where there were boys. I have girls. There were boys at these parties that I was at yesterday for 4th of July, and boy, boys are energetic. We'll just put it that way. Okay. So Melissa gained 20 pounds in 1 year just from overeating on Sundays. And she was, quote unquote, good all week. She stuck to her meal plan. And then she'd allow herself a cheat day on Saturday. She wouldn't necessarily overeat, but she'd have what she considered, you know, bad food. You know, usually after one of her sons had a baseball tournament, so she'd have pizza or, you know, something like that. And the next morning, she would feel guilty, and she would vow to start a new diet on Monday. So Saturday she had her cheat day, didn't you know, kind of ate the wrong foods, but didn't necessarily overeat. Sunday, she was like, oh, I'm going on a diet tomorrow, Monday. And so every Sunday, she overdid it with everything that was on her do not eat list. Bread, cake, cheese, pasta, ice cream. She thought, it's the last time I'm going to eat it until I lose weight, so I might as well have it now. On Monday, she would start her new diet, and she would stick to it throughout the week, sometimes 2 weeks, even as long as a month. But inevitably, she would go off her meal plan, and she would feel guilty. And on Sunday, she would vow to start dieting again the next day. But for now, she would say, I'm going to have all the ice cream I want. all those Sundays added up to 20 extra pounds. So the cycle of dieting and then making up for deprivation by overeating was making Melissa gain more and more and more weight. I convinced her to stop dieting, which took some convincing. She was very afraid if she went off her diet that she would just blow up like a balloon. I convinced her to try a new way, and she was definitely skeptical, but she allowed herself to trust me. After all, her way was not working for her. And if you're listening and you can relate to Melissa, then it's probably not working for you either. So Melissa stopped dieting, gave herself permission to eat everything she wanted in moderation, and as a result, she began eating more intuitively. She lost weight, and she has kept that weight off for more than a decade and is in better shape in her 40s than she has ever been in her life. So Melissa's story illustrates how the anticipation of deprivation only makes you want something more. When you take away that expectation of deprivation, you have a choice. When you stop eating something in the present because you think you're going to be deprived of it in the future, you can decide if you want it or not. I'm not sure that makes sense. Let me restate that. What am I trying to say? That if you say, hey, I can have this anytime, then you can decide how much you want of it. But if you say, oh, I better have it now, like she did, I better have it now because it's going to be taken away from me starting tomorrow, you're going to have more of it than you would normally have. And that's a problem. So allowing yourself to trust in abundance makes you decide whether you even want it or not. Total paradigm shift, and it does take trust and it takes practice, but it is possible. Okay, my call-in number, if you want to talk with me, is 818-602-4929. That's 818-602-4929. I'd love to talk with you. But if you don't call, I am still going to keep talking. I have a question now from a listener, and this is from Anna or Anna. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. She is from Venezuela, and she asks, as a psychoanalyst, which techniques do you believe are the most effective to use in therapy when you're working with people that struggle with overeating or binging or eating the wrong foods? Well, Anna, first of all, your English is amazing, and I'm super thrilled that you're listening in Venezuela. This week was International Week, England and Venezuela. So cool. Okay, so to answer your question, everyone is unique. Everyone is unique, so I don't necessarily use the same techniques for everyone. That said, I do see one commonality over and over and over, and that is the difficulty experiencing feelings and self-comforting with words. So a lot of people use their bodies or food to express what's going on inside. And that's why it's important to help people translate the language of their body to actual conflicts and emotions. And I'm not talking about body language in the usual sense. I'm talking about decoding the messages of your body. So what do I mean by this? Well, if you've ever said anything along the lines of, I ate so much my stomach hurts, my pants are tight and uncomfortable, what I ate made me feel so sick, thinking about that just gives me a headache, thinking about that gives me a stomach ache, that's your body giving actual physical expression to what perhaps you cannot express emotionally. Physical pain or discomfort often reflects painful or uncomfortable emotional states, if you're using food to get to that place where you're in physical pain. Lots of people use physical sensations to describe upsetting emotions. I had a patient once who could never say that bothered me. She would just say, oh, that makes my stomach hurt. Oh, that makes my head hurt. And we see this all the time in kids. That they don't say, hey, I don't want to go to school because the kids at school are hurting my feelings. Instead, they say, oh, my tummy hurts. I can't go to school today. My tummy hurts. In fact, recently, my own 9-year-old complained of having a really bad stomach ache. And I ruled out the usual suspects. Wasn't food poisoning. Wasn't the flu. She wasn't allergic to anything. Turns out she was nervous about going to day camp. summer camp. She was worried about fitting in, worried if she'd make new friends, worried about taking the swim test. She was really worried about that. And all kinds of things. Now, she didn't tell me about this in words. Her anxiety was expressed in a painful tummy. And I know the problem was anxiety because talking it through made the pain stop. When she felt better emotionally, her stomach felt better too. And this is just one example of the emotional to physical connection. And here's another common expression. You've for sure heard it, and I'm pretty sure you've said it. The expression is, I feel fat. Because here's the thing, you can't actually feel fat. Fat is not a feeling. Fat is a substance, not a feeling. So substitute an emotion, mad, sad, afraid, anxious, for the word fat and see what you're actually communicating. And by the way, nearly all emotions can be distilled down to those four: mad, sad, glad, and afraid. Also, maybe you're afraid that your emotions, needs, or wants are too much, too big for others. So I feel fat can be code for something like, I'm afraid I want, need, or feel too much. It becomes, there's too much of me. I'm fat. Not I have all these big feelings. I feel fat can also be code for I'm not good enough. Or some people have guilt, taking up space in the world, feeling like they matter, having appropriate needs or demands, and they feel like they themselves, their bodies, are too big. So if you get angry with yourself about being quote-unquote fat, then maybe you're turning the anger you feel towards others and boomeranging it back onto yourself. Again, huge feelings can become actually feeling huge. And consider how intense issues in our language, intense issues are said to be weighty or heavy. Like, oh, that was intense. That was really heavy. Actually, this is something I talked about with a caller a few weeks ago. I think her name was Alex. I think I got her name wrong, actually. She said that she thought she was a lot bigger than she actually was. So again, fat is not a feeling. Fat is a substance. So if you're feeling fat, really check in with yourself about what you really mean by that. Another thing I hear a lot, in fact, one of our first callers talked about this, Christina. In fact, I think she was the first caller. She called in and talked about how she was good during the day with food, but at night, everything went south. Everything went to hell. And she said she often ate so much that her stomach hurt. When emotional pain is too much to take, painful emotions can be converted into physical sensations. So if you are lonely and you're using food to fill an internal void and you eat until it hurts, you could be turning the ache of loneliness into actual physical pain, because physical pain is easier to manage and get rid of than emotional pain. Here's another thing I hear a lot. In fact, I heard it yesterday at Fourth of July parties. You may have as well if you were at a Fourth of July party. Oh, I'm really in the mood for potato chips, or oh, I'm so in the mood for ice cream. Well, remember the food mood formula? Crunchy foods are code for I'm upset and angry. If you're upset with someone and you can't or won't express your feelings, you may eat something crunchy as a way of physically expressing anger. Ice cream is associated with a need for comfort and soothing. So if you're in the mood for ice cream, or ooh, that ice cream looks really good, that's a sign you may need some comfort. So by cracking the code, you discover what your true feelings, wishes, and needs are, and then you can start finding new ways to express yourself. And that's when all these food problems go away. And I want to take a moment to give you some hope and some encouragement. To change your relationship to food, you absolutely must change your relationship to yourself. That's how you make peace with food, by making peace with yourself. And when you feel good about yourself, when you respond to yourself with respect and interest instead of contempt, when you are curious, not critical, you respond to yourself in a whole new way, then eating becomes just a pleasant experience instead of a constant battleground. It really is possible. And I just want to give you some encouragement that even if it feels impossible, like my guy who was struggling with a tiger, battling a tiger on a daily basis, it really can become a little kitty cat. Okay, now I have a question from someone who wants to be anonymous. This person says, I heard the show where you started talking about food triggers, but you didn't finish. You talked about getting mad and expressing that instead of stuffing it. Can you say more about the other food triggers? Yes, this is a question I got from a caller asking about the best way to deal with food triggers, and I said that food triggers are actually usually situational triggers. Most people know about emotional eating, and they're often aware that it's not what they're eating that's the problem, it's what's eating at them, but they still think they're being triggered by food. Really, they're being triggered by a situation. So one trigger is just having difficult emotions, just being upset, sad, angry, frustrated. If you stuff your feelings, nothing is going to change. If you're triggered by your emotions, you've got to express them, and that means first identifying them and acknowledging them and then feeling them. And that's the part where a lot of people kind of get tripped up, because they'll say, I realized that I was mad. And think that they felt their feelings. Saying, that makes me angry is not expressing your feelings. That's identifying it. You cannot think away your feelings by merely identifying them. So you can't say, oh, God, I'm really mad. That does nothing. You have to say, oh, that pisses me off. Right? You've got to use some oomph, some intensity. That helps you get rid of the feeling as opposed to just recognizing that it's there. So the next time you open that fridge or that pantry door or go to the drive-thru, check in with yourself on whether you're upset, whether you're sad, angry, frustrated, worried, anxious. There's just so many different feelings that you might be having. And if you weren't thinking about food or what to eat, what would be eating at you? Try to identify what is the feeling or the thought that you're turning to food. By turning to food, you're turning away from something else. And remember, you can't think away your feelings. You cannot stuff them down. You can't positive think them away. And you cannot let them go. The only way to get rid of feelings, as counterintuitive as it may sound, is to actually feel them. So that's one situational trigger. Another trigger is you're lonely. Now, the situation to loneliness means that you need to be with someone is to call a friend, or it's to be a friend to yourself. When you're alone with a critical part of yourself, it's very lonely. It's very lonely indeed. But when you cultivate a part of yourself that can be nice and kind to yourself, you will feel solitude instead of loneliness. So loneliness is the feeling of wanting to be with another person. And when you're alone and feeling lonely, it's just a horrible, horrible feeling. But when you can be alone with yourself, then it changes into solitude, which is much more bearable and sometimes even pleasant. And when you can be supportive and nice to yourself, then, you know, it's a nice experience of being with yourself. And when you feel that way, you're a lot more likely to feel that other people will have the same experience of being with you. Another common trigger is that you are amped up and you're just really revved up and you need to relax. Food can calm you down. It really has a sedative effect. But you know, there are other ways to calm down. You can calm your body by using a muscle relaxation exercise. You can meditate, you can walk, you can work out, you can do anything physical just to calm your body, because a relaxed body is the first step to relaxing your mind. And when you do that, you don't need food to calm yourself. And the opposite is actually the next trigger. The opposite situational trigger is that you're exhausted or sleepy and you want to wake up. I can't tell you how many people say, oh, I was really tired, so, oh, I ate some cookies because I needed to wake up. Well, if you're tired, that means you need to sleep. you need to sleep, right? And if you can't sleep, then you need to maybe take a cat nap or just recognize that you're tired and not use food to wake yourself up. Because if you use food to perk yourself up when you're tired, that it's not emotional hunger, but it's the wrong response to exhaustion. When you're tired, you need to rest. And food won't perk you up for long. Your body needs rest, not food. By the way, a lot of times people, when they're babies and every time they cry, they're fed, babies get the idea that any discomfort is going to be resolved with food. So it doesn't matter if they're hungry, if they're tired, if they need to their diaper changed, if they want to be held. All of these reasons for why babies might cry, if someone gives them a bottle or a boob, if someone feeds them, then they learn, like, oh, any kind of distress is solved with food. And those babies become adults who kind of think food is the save-all for everything, right? So it's really important to kind of identify these situational triggers. The last trigger is boredom. Boredom's a big one because boredom actually means that you don't have anything to do. You feel restless. You need to occupy yourself in some way. And the solution to boredom is to do something. And by the way, really check in with yourself to see if you're actually bored or if you're lonely. Because a lot of times people think they're bored when they're really lonely or empty. And when you're lonely and empty, we've already talked about, you know, you need to call a friend, you need to be a friend to yourself. When you're empty and you cannot be with yourself, same thing, you need to cultivate a kind of a kind, nurturing response to yourself. Boredom is, I call it an umbrella emotion because it kind of covers up other things. Boredom can cover loneliness, emptiness, sadness, all kinds of other things. It's easier to feel bored than it is to feel sad, lonely, upset, or empty. And I also just want to say something. This kind of approach to change, it is not easy. It is not easy at all. This kind of thinking takes a lot of effort, and it is not for the faint of heart. Here's the thing. It is actually easier to go on diet after diet after diet. It is easier to focus on food. It is easier to focus on your weight than it is to think about and process difficult or upsetting thoughts and feelings. But if you don't recognize what's going on in your head and your heart, if you don't learn to respond differently to yourself, nothing will ever change. But if you rise to the challenge, if you become responsive and nice, if you're a friend to yourself, as trite as that may sound, it's so true and so necessary, then you know what? You get rid of the problem for good. It's the difference between waking up every day and vowing to stick to your meal plan, thinking all day about staying away from carbs, counting calories, counting fat grams, obsessing about every bite you take, or waking up every day and being free. Being liberated from all the thoughts, the preoccupation, the horrible obsession, the thinking about food all the time, the feeling bad about what you eat, feeling bad about yourself. But a lot of people say they don't want to just lose weight. They want to lose the preoccupation they feel with thinking about food all the time. And I want you guys, everyone who's listening, I want you to wake up and think about having a good day instead of being good. When it comes to food. Doesn't that sound good? So your ticket to that is identifying and working through what's eating at you. And after that, it's freedom. That's how you win the diet war. If you'd like to chat with me, please give me a call. The number is 818-602-5400. 818-602-4929. That's 818-602-4929. You can also tweet at Win the Diet War. So here's a question from Bryce, who lives in D.C. He says, I'm confused about all the different messages regarding what to eat and what not to eat. What do you consider normal eating? Oh, this is such a great question, Bryce. Such a simple question and such an important question and such a difficult question to answer for so many people. Because you know what? We have lost touch with what normal eating is. And to answer your question, I'm going to use a definition from a registered dietitian named Ellen Satter. She's kind of a superstar dietitian, actually. She has a really terrific definition of normal eating. Okay, so here's the definition of normal eating according to Ellen Satter. That's E-L-L-Y-N-S-A-T-T-E-R, if you want to look her up. She says, normal eating is being able to eat when you are hungry and continue eating until you are satisfied. It's being able to choose food you like and truly get enough of it, not just stop eating because you think you should. Normal eating is being able to use some moderate constraint in your food selection to get the right food, but not being so restrictive that you miss out on pleasurable foods. Normal eating is giving yourself permission to eat sometimes because you are happy, sad, bored, or just because it feels good. She says sometimes. Normal eating is eating three meals a day most of the time, but it can also be choosing to munch or graze through the day. It is leaving some cookies on the plate because you know you could have some tomorrow. And it is eating more now because they taste so wonderful when they are fresh. And this is me saying, more now, but not too much more. When you know you can have them, you won't have too much. You can have more, but not too much. You'll allow yourself to have more, and you won't want too much, is what I'm saying. Okay, back to Ellen Satter. Normal eating is overeating at times, feeling stuffed and uncomfortable. It is also undereating at times and wishing you had more. Normal eating is trusting your body to make up for your mistakes in eating. Normal eating takes up some of your time and attention, but it keeps its place as only one area of your life. Normal eating is flexible. It varies in response to your schedule, your hunger, and your proximity to food. Normal eating is not perfect eating. It is not clean eating. This is me talking, by the way. Not Ellen. Normal eating is not perfect eating. It is not clean eating. It is not anything like that. It is trusting your body. And that is simple to say and tough to do, but practice definitely makes progress. So I love that definition of normal eating because she normalizes, just being perfectly imperfect when it comes to food, as we should be with all things. We are not, perfection is unattainable. We are perfectly imperfect beings, and we have to expect that of ourselves with food as well. All right, here's a question from Chrissy with a K. She wrote, hi, I've been obese since childhood. I am tired of being this way. I have to start releasing weight and loving myself. I'm tired of my depression due to my weight issue. I want to live a healthy lifestyle and be truly happy. I live in an isolated community that doesn't have a grocery store. We have a restaurant that sells fast food, and everything on the menu is deep fried. Nothing in the store is healthy. Everything is... It is all processed food, no healthy veggies at all. What do you suggest I do in this situation? And then she asks what her first step should be in terms of losing weight. Well, Chrissy, that sounds like a very challenging situation for you. As far as the unavailability of fresh food, all you can do is your best, given the limitations that you're faced with. And I actually have a suggestion for you, which is Amazon. Like, you can get anything on Amazon. I don't know what I would do without Amazon. It saves me so much time. And I bet Amazon could deliver some veggies or something healthy to you, even if it's in a can. It's better than having fried fast food. So that's my practical suggestion. But Chrissy, again, if you want to lose weight, the first thing you have to do is stop dieting. The best way to fail at weight loss is to go on a diet. Diets are restrictive, lead to hunger, slow your metabolism, and when that happens, your body becomes more efficient, so it requires less fuel, fewer calories to keep your blood flowing, your heart beating, and your organs working. So when you go off the diet, because everyone goes off the diet, you gain weight more easily because now your body needs fewer calories just for maintenance. It's a vicious, horrible cycle to, you know, to diet and to lose weight, and you go off the diet and boom, it's back on like seemingly overnight. And it just, you gain weight more easily, and then you go on another diet because you're so bummed out about that. And it just becomes this terrible, vicious cycle. Also, if you're not taking in enough calories or enough of the right kind of calories, you lose muscle. And when that happens, you also don't burn as many calories and you don't need as many calories because muscle requires more calories than fat. So you gain weight more easily once you're off the diet for that reason as well. Essentially, here's the thing that the $60 billion with a B, $60 billion diet industry does not want you to know. Dieting makes you gain weight in the long run. Diets make you fat. Now, in terms of the psychology of eating, which is my area, you know, ultimately diets fail because they deal with food. Also, they focus on what you're eating and not why. And also the cycle of losing weight by dieting, then regaining the weight, it causes frustration, anxiety, a sense of powerlessness, feelings of failure. And I, Chrissy, your email, you know, it just really, I could feel your pain. I could feel your frustration, and it's just so hard to be in that helpless, hopeless place. And then if you use food to cope with painful feelings, the painful and upsetting experience of dieting can actually lead to overeating. And of course, diets do not address the underlying conflicts that make you turn to food in the first place. You know, using food for comfort, for distraction, to go numb, to be symbolically fulfilled, to express pain. So dieting keeps you in a perpetual battle with yourself. So to release the weight and start loving yourself, Chrissy, you got to stop dieting and start tuning into your thoughts, feelings, needs, wants, and attend to all the other areas in your life where you need you. Be supportive to yourself. When you do that, you will lose weight naturally. And, you know, here's some things to think about. If you're a regular listener or if you follow my blog or video series, you have heard this already, but believe me, this is one of those times when repetition is a good thing, because this is something you need to hear over and over and over until you really internalize it. And that is the reason why people turn to food when they're upset. So for example, Marina, who battled her weight all her life, wanted to know why she turned to food for comfort. She said, "Why can't I be addicted to exercise instead of to food? Why food?" And by the way, I once had someone ask me why they couldn't be addicted to meth instead of to food. And they said, "Well, if I were addicted to meth, I'd be skinny." And they were serious. She was absolutely serious. Can you believe it? I couldn't even believe it. When this woman said that, I was momentarily at a loss for words. I was just like flabbergasted. Or as my friends in England might say, gobsmacked. Don't you love that expression? Gobsmacked. Okay, so what I told this woman and what I told Marina, and what I'm telling all of you, is that as human beings, our first experience of love, bonding, and relationship is the experience of being fed. So on a very primal level, turning to food is an unconscious way of recapturing that blissful state of union that we experienced as babies while being fed. Sometimes eating is a way of avoiding emotions. Sometimes it's a way of expressing emotions. And sometimes it has to do with not fully trusting relationships. People can be unpredictable and unreliable. They can lie to you, they can cheat on you, they can disappoint you, annoy you, and they can change. Unlike people, food is always the same. Food is always available. Food is always predictable. So if you feel safer with food than with people, it's important to explore your anxieties and expectations about relationships. When you trust the bonds of friendship, the bonds of relating to another person, you are less likely to use food as a substitute for people. Again, it's easier to focus on your weight than to deal with an unpredictable boss, teacher, significant other, or friend. You can't control a person, but you can try to control yourself. You can kind of try to control your weight. And that turns a relational issue between you and someone else into kind of an internal conflict between you and you, or between you and food. And this is some food for thought for you. Just recognize that our relationship to ourselves is the basis to everything. It's our relation. It informs our relationship to other people, to the world. So when you change and cultivate a kind, caring, nurturing relationship to yourself, it's just such a relief, and you feel so much better in the world. And also ask yourself, what's weighing on you? I once posted a graphic on my Facebook page that said, if he's only interested in your legs, breasts, or thighs, send him to KFC. Don't you love that? And although that quote was specific to women, the idea that we are our bodies is one that we must challenge as individuals and as a culture, because body image has to do with our sense of self. And when we don't feel good about ourselves, we may try to change our bodies as a way of feeling better. So losing weight in that way can be a way of trying to resolve like a psychological conflict through a physical action. Because we always get the message that when we lose weight, our lives will improve, we'll be more confident, we'll be outgoing, we'll be relaxed. The illusion is that by controlling the number on the scale, we can manage many aspects of our lives, or we can actually control other people. If I lose weight, he'll be interested in me, or if I lose weight, she'll like me more. And weight can also symbolically represent the qualities about yourself you want to get rid of: shyness, insecurity, anxiety. So in this way, you know, if you feel that way, I'll be more this or less that when I lose weight, then losing weight becomes equivalent to losing what you think is unacceptable about yourself. It's also less painful to focus on losing weight than to think about disappointments, fears, concerns, worries, or anxieties. So staying focused on your body image then distracts you from these kind of difficult thoughts and weighty emotions that need your attention. I also think that there's a significant problem in our culture, and I'm sure you agree with me. It privileges the body as the primary self. Social media, TV, movies, magazines, we are presented with images of models and people who are filtered, airbrushed, and photoshopped, and they totally skew the idea of what a normal person actually looks like. And we have to remember that our bodies are part of our overall sense of ourselves. Our bodies do not define us, and you've got to take care of the other aspects of yourself that go beyond the physical. The intellectual, emotional, relational, spiritual, creative, and more. And so, when you feel good about yourself, when you respond to yourself with respect and interest instead of contempt, when you're curious, not critical, my favorite expression, when you respond to yourself in a new way, then eating again just becomes breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and not a constant battleground. So I want to thank you for being here with me today. And if you have any questions or comments that you'd like me to cover next week, please email me. You can reach me at dr.nina@winthedietwar.com. You can also tweet me at @WinTheDietWar or call me next week at 818-602-4929. I'm here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Pacific here on LA Talk Radio, to give you the skinny on weight loss without dieting. And I'd love to hear from you, so call in or send me a message on Twitter or Facebook with any questions that you'd like me to cover on the show. See you next week.
You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.